Hello, this is Cameron and Bob, and this is the 43rd episode being recorded on December 23rd, 2021. And we're looking at my book, and we're on page 80, or at the bottom of 79. Is that what it is, Cameron, bottom of 79?
Yeah, I would like to start there because there's some questions that arise from the bottom of 79 that are important for the series on page 80.
Okay.
Yeah. So do you want me to explain why I think that's
Yeah, I'd be important? Good if you start talking. Yeah.
Okay. So, Bob, I think the blue is you talking, right?
Yeah, that's the casual oral explanation.
Right. So Bob says the tactility of television then became the global hologram of mixed corporate media environments, which were interplaying light tactility. Then the Android meme imploded it all, shrunk it, and permitted tactility cubed, went to a third level. So the problem I have there is when you speak of something like tactility, as if tactility wasn't basic. So I agree with what you're going to go on to say about the quadrivium and the trivium, but I don't think that tactility is limited to the trivium. So I don't think that the and I could well be wrong. I'm waiting to be instructed. I believe that the quadrivium is a higher level type of tactility. Just as a weather front, of course, consists of chemical elements, but they're not consequential for understanding what's going on in a weather front.
Yeah, I don't say the trivium is tactile. Where is that said?
Well, you say that the Android meme imploded it all, shrunk it, and permitted tactility cubed, went to a third level. So I'm not sure that tactility has different values in the sense of narrative. I think it has different values in terms of the synchronic consideration of human experience. But I have trouble understanding tactility as changing with time.
Yeah, okay. So what I mean is the tactility of television. So in the 50s, television is quite a tactile medium, and McLuhan says electricity is tactility.
Absolutely, yes.
So you could say the telegraph, the whole electric era, telegraph, radio, computers, television, not satellite, say. So I mean the television artifact itself is tactile. Then that's in the 50s. Then you have the computer and the satellite coming in the late 50s, and they take over in the 50, in the 60s. And so you have an interplay of automobiles, movies, every medium in the global theater. And so I call this mixed corporate media environments. A cup is a private media, private artifact. But corporate media are electric media, automobiles, movies, the whole layout buffet of the 20th century. So the interplay of movies and TV and newspapers and everything, that interplay, I consider that a hologram effect, and it's that interplay is tactility. So when I say the tactility of television then became the global hologram of mixed corporate media, I should have said maybe the tactility of television then becomes the tactility of the interplay of the global hologram of mixed corporate media environments. Well, I do say which were interplaying like tactility. Anything more about tactility is nebulous. I mean, I don't know what it is. It's the interplay. It's not a sense. McLuhan defines it as an interplay. Sometimes go ahead.
So what I see going on, and which may also be an aspect of what you're talking about, is if somebody like my professor at Princeton, Thomas Kuhn, if he's looking at the history of science, then part of what he has to look at is when people got stuff wrong, but there was some sort of illumination going on at the same time. And so what I see you setting out is a kind of history of how McLuhan came to see what media are doing. And in order to understand that, then you have to understand how he went from a relatively simple structure like the trivium to much more complicated structures like the quadrivium. But that doesn't mean that the trivium sort of was obviated. It simply means that the trivium, like the chemical elements, let's say, that the a chemical element doesn't do much for you if you want to understand genetics, or if you want to understand biology, or if you want to understand organic chemistry. You have to be able to understand much more complex structures. So I see what McLuhan is doing is he looks at the trivium, and he understands that the trivium has a kind of history going back at least to Plato, and arguably to 2,500 years before that in the Egyptians. But the question arises, well, if we've known the trivium all this time, why don't we understand more about the world? And McLuhan's answer, I believe, is that, well, we're looking at the wrong thing to do our explanations and our predictions. And so what we have to do is we have to probe complex structures that, in a way, are built on the trivium, but in another way, are what we have to focus on and forget the trivium if we want to understand the big weather fronts of modernity.
No, I agree. And in simple terms, the trivium is the visual space. Speech, people say, is oral. Rhetoric is oral. Grammar, maybe visual. And dialectics is visual. But the word is wedded. Orality, the last 2,000 more years, is wedded to the phonetic alphabet and to literacy. So I put the trivium in the literate camp, and the quadrivium is non-literate. Music.
Well, that's right, except that it's not the case that the trivium itself was literate. It's a certain bias of the trivium.
Yeah.
Right? And that a certain bias of the trivium needs to be understood in two ways. So in one way, the trivium amazingly allows itself to be distorted. But in another way, the trivium underlies everything that's going on, and the great thinkers forever have tried to explain how the trivium is there. And what we need to do is look past the various biases to the underlying structure.
Yep. So do you see the quadrivium is more right hemisphered? The right hemisphere arts, arithmetic,
well,
geometry?
The big difference is that the trivium, at least as McLuhan understood it, in line with its literate bias, was individual. So somebody could take one aspect of the trivium, and another guy, let's say in scholasticism, could have another view.
Yeah.
But when you move to the quadrivium, you're talking about a kind of consciousness that's not individual.
Yeah.
So the danger McLuhan saw was that the values that were developed in 2,000 years on the basis of the trivium could be destroyed by this mass consciousness that we've introduced with telephone, motor car, movie, radio, television, et cetera.
Right.
So he's looking for some way to balance what we had to where we are.
Right. So that is the issue until you get to the 70s and 80s. So I have laid out here the 1940s, the trivium. You don't have a blasting right hemisphere, which television brings in, and then the computers and satellite. That gets in the 50s. So the last gasp of visuality is the 40s, with the trivium plus advertising and comics. Advertising is, I guess, an update of rhetoric. Comics is maybe rhetoric, too. But they're new post-visual space media. So we're right. not in pure trivium anymore. We're not in pure trivium right. in the 20th century at
well,
all.
That's right, in the sense that the quadrivium is not the trivium as manipulated by individuals.
Yes.
And in fact, it never was. So McLuhan had to come to understand that what he had worked on for 20 years, basically, was a literate point of view.
Yeah.
And he had to give that up. And he had to give it up, let's say, starting in 1949 or sometime right around 1950.
Okay, take the letter to Pound. He says, I've been, he goes into the secret society. He says, no critic should know this. Why didn't you guys tell me this? I've wasted 20 years on English studies. Remember that sentence?
Sure, yeah.
And he was expressing... without the media form metaphors, without the Innes effect, he's talking content there, but he is expressing, he says, I got to update my perceptions. And he probably already
Correct.
Had. He wouldn't admit something. He was still struggling. He figured it out, you know what I mean? So he could say it's past. It was a crisis from 1945 or 46, say, before he met Pound. Pound is a really important influence on him. So do you follow what I'm saying? That
I think that's right. But when you say he finally figured out, I don't think he ever did. I think he probed things in really interesting ways and opened up new ways of understanding the world. But he didn't figure out how to communicate it. So his it's like what he said of Wyndham Lewis's Cosmic Man, that it was a hydrogen bomb set up in the desert with effect nil.
Yes. Okay, so, he wasn't a perfect communicator. I don't want to go into that. We've discussed that. He was pretty good.
Okay.
He got known, you know, he got something out there. And it's up to us to, quote, correct it, refine it, change it, figure out how to communicate. And today,
I'm not at all putting them down.
Right. You know what?
Failure in the sense that I was talking about is a tremendous thing.
Yeah. At least he tackled something no one else even knew there was a problem.
Correct.
Well, here's what the next thing I'm reminded. He writes to Pound in that early 50s, that you guys dealt with the word. You were learning, you know, the retrieval of orality or the value of the word or the word its ground. You know, the men of 1914 were involved with the word. He says, that's not my problem. In my world, the word is a drug. So that indicates he knows that the word emphasis maybe of his 40s life is not applicable anymore. And
Correct.
He's got a whole new problem of communication
Correct.
When the word is a drug.
Correct, correct. But always understanding that he didn't want to give up the word. He wanted to find a new way to understand it and to use it within this new environment.
Yeah, and one of the metaphorical way he said that, I think in your first explorations, was what use is it for a book? He was trying to find, retrieve a use for the book, which I think he did do well on that. He wrote a book that startled people. You know, now it's sort of odd, but back then nobody knew what the hell he was talking about. He certainly got attention with his books. They were different, right? He brought the book back at the same time as Mao had his little red book going around in Asia.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
That lasted until 69 or so.
Right. And that's the period for Marshall, 66 to 69, the same thing. Did I ever mention that Eric said in April 1980, Toronto Star closing up the center? They're talking about, well, Eric might take it over. They're not sure if it is going to close. And he ends his interview saying that Mao Zedong has the same meaning as McLuhan, as Marshall McLuhan. He just sort of says the two names are similar. And I always wondered what that was. Never had a chance to ask him what was the meaning. But I thought it's interesting in light of the little book that Mao had going was the same time as McLuhan's little book, The Medium is a Massage, was going around. Two parallel actions there. And in the way, the last gasp of the book, no more books after that. Publishing industry just becomes junk with occasional, old-fashioned guy like Norman Mailer or somebody putting out a nice novel. But it was not constituent anymore. So we moved into quadrivial, and that's why I like Baudrillard saying that McLuhan was a musician. He was a musician.
I agree with that.
Beg your pardon?
I agree with that.
Yeah. So he's moving into quadrivial. So I have here the trivium, rhetoric, grammar, dialectics, plus advertising and comics. That's the 40s. And then the 50s, you got the quadrivium, and I line up the four aspects, astronomy, geometry, music, and arithmetic, and I make them expanded, right? So I've got telephone, motor car, movie, radio, television. And then I bring in astronomy. You have McLuhan's three Copernican revolutions. So it's a different kind of astronomy going on.
Yeah, that's from 1973. So it's you're understanding McLuhan in the 50s from 20 years later.
Yes, well, he has an article in the 50s explorations. This other guy does the Copernican revolutions. He doesn't update it like Marshall, but he runs through six levels of it or something.
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, so I thought, well, that Marshall was thinking in those terms, but he let someone else write it. Or Marshall got ideas from it. So that's my alibi, that there was a little inkling of it in the 50s.
All right. We'll buy that.
Okay, good. And then geometry, you go from Euclidean to non-Euclidean geometries. Arithmetic, the new kind of arithmetic is the ratings, Nielsen ratings and Big Brother's GNT and statistics.
Yeah.
And then music is everywhere.
Notice what's happening here. Because when you say the trivium plus advertising and comics, I think what you're saying is that here's McLuhan, who's done this 400-page-plus thesis on the trivium, but it doesn't account for his interests in the larger environment, which include advertising and comics. So he has to figure out, well, what's the relationship between the trivium and understanding comics. And then in the 50s, when he understands that the individual trivium is actually the quadrivium, then he looks at the telephone, motor car, movie, radio, television, astronomy, and he's saying, these are very important in my lab for probing what's going on with the quadrivium, and similarly with the other things that you bring out.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I would say that, you know, I have here for the 60s the quadrivium plus satellite, cyborg, mixed corporate media. It's past the quadrivium. Now it's in a totally new non-academic or something, end of the public intellectual, end of any kind of role for the university and for learning.
What we could say is that when McLuhan looks at advertising and comics in the 1940s, then he understands that the trivium, although it's been used for a couple thousand years to illuminate the world, is problematic. So then he moves on to the quadrivium.
Yeah.
And he looks at these things. And then by the time he gets to the 60s, then he realizes that the quadrivium, as he had been looking at it, now needs to be probed in terms of the satellite, cyborg, this corporate media,
yeah,
global theater. So he's always finding ways of, you could say, of disproving his theories.
That's right.
So later in Laws of Media, he and Eric make a big deal of Popper's theory about being able to criticize.
The null hypothesis, I think, is sometimes called.
Yeah.
See, the trivium is the individual, quadrivium is collective, but man in the 60s, as we've talked about before, is tribal and autonomous. It's a new quality that no culture's ever had before. So that's, if you're following about going from the individual to the collective of the 50s and then to the mass man, that's really a new situation. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can go with that. Sure.
Yeah, you're also a super angel. You're everywhere at once. So
yes.
I'd almost...
The whole question of you and you're everywhere at once, you has basically imploded or exploded. What needs to be explicated is what is the you given this new environment?
Say, what is the you? Is that what you said?
Yeah, you.
Yeah. What is the you?
The why or you.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you say that we're into a whole new environment, it's not the case that the what the we is or the I is or the you is. It's not the case that these things remain fixed or foundational. Instead, they get imploded, and you get into a very sort of crazy situation that in many ways caused big problems for McLuhan personally.
Yeah, yeah. So I would probably even drop quadrivium from the 60s. I don't know what made me think to keep it in there, but it was probably good to keep it there and rather than just say satellite, cyborg, and have no plus. But we're go back up to my oral thing on page 79 where I say, then the Android meme imploded all. Now, I'm saying the Android meme starts in 1960. That's when MIT and the digital program really got going. And it's at various universities until 69. And that's when they start to build the internet in LA. And they set up September 69, October 69, November and December. Each month they add another terminal or IMP, IMP, which I can't remember what it stood for. You know, each university contributed to the beginning of this network. So that's 69, and then that's developed up till 90. So I'm saying the Android meme as ground is from 60 to 90. And then my chart is a picture of the after image of the Android meme, which is the 90s and what we call the Internet or the World Wide Web. So that's the long-range thing. I'm going to show how, as the Android meme, you know, really shrinks and gets tighter, the global concentration camp, you know, it becomes the global membrane, but it's not complete slavery because there's more and more autonomy that the digital media is giving people.
Well, they think it's autonomy.
Right. No, they can titillate themselves with no community pressure on how they're doing it. There's no community controls anymore, like neighborhood controls. You know, just social life was gone in the sense of community policing.
How is that different from the 60s?
No, that is the 60s. It starts in the 60s, and it goes for 30 years.
Okay.
And, you know, it's really radical in the 90s. All the walls and the after-image walls, everything collapses. And we don't recover. Nobody can claim they got anywhere. they didn't retrieve this, they didn't retrieve that. Just endless frustration and more and more ecstatic drug taking, you know, to obliterate
right.
yourself.
Right.
On all levels. Okay, so that's the broad view of where I'm going. So we go back to 60s, and I've got the Quadrivium, plus satellite, cyborg, mixed corporate media, that's all happening. And those are huge. And what's interesting is people don't get the disservices of that. They're celebrating the new autonomy, the new tribalism. It has a lot of fun in the 60s, or it's presented as fun. There's a lot of people pissed off at the fun. They don't like it. But nobody thinks they're going to get wiped out in a collective level that's coming. Now, McLuhan uh-huh. starts to say in the 70s, we're now the planet of the dead. That's a serious uh-huh. statement, you know?
Right. But there were, of course, people that were protesting about nuclear weapons then
yeah.
in a way that people aren't today.
Right.
I forget the name of the Australian woman who was a very powerful figure in that
Helen.
Movement.
Helen somebody.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, I know who you mean. And there's an example of someone who's a big deal, a saint in other times, right? In other times, she'd be a saint. She's an unknown. She's an unknown person. She's gone.
Yeah.
You know? No memory.
Yeah. She would have been a Saint Joan, I'd say. What'd
you say? Saint Helen?
She would have been a Saint Joan.
Yes, yes. I forgot to say, when you were talking about the 40s and the it's the individual, the last gasp of the individual, that's the brilliant statement by McLuhan. I think it's at the beginning of Southern Quality, 1945-46. He's talking about the effect of the atomic bomb. And he says, this is it. There's no more individuality, no more causes. And he said, the person who's going to find it the hardest to deal with is the artist. No more individual Gutenberg creativity, what they call the Gutenberg arts. That's amazing. And what happens is you see cultures are business for the next 30 years. You have the supernova of all the arts. More and more movies, more and more TV shows, more and more opera, more and more sculpture, more and more new art, more and more amateur arts. Incredible, Eric's word, electronissance. Incredible.
Sorry, what's that word? What?
Electronissance. That's what he called our time. Not the Renaissance, an electronissance.
Oh, I see, electronissance.
Yeah.
Bob, I have to, the dog is scratching at the door. I just need to let him out.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
Yeah, it's really, as I enjoyed and watched the arts explode and become in what I call on my chart Baroque spirals, excess and all this stuff, and the artists, the individual artists, the dreamers of the Bauhaus and the Pre-Raphaelites, all those cults or secret societies of artists that were trying to have an influence in the society during the beginnings of the Industrial Age, they reached their pinnacle. They were running McLuhan called them in the 50s, the penthouse artist. He had TV programs. It was an amazing time of chemical body creativity. But in the end, it was really just artists being the content of a gaping maw, a monster of endless output and input. So I don't know what I think I picked up that McLuhan was warning about this. So I enjoyed the arts, but I said, this is Norman Mailer. He's going to get smeared. The Beatles are going to get smeared. Everybody's going to get wiped out. I could see that. That was the warning of his 1970 title, Cultures Are Business. And so I found it very interesting from the 70s and 80s that you had to know how to live. And a big deal of that was don't try to do anything or think you're going to get somewhere. You couldn't put meaning into whatever you were doing. And McLuhan even right. said, why do anything more than 6 months? He said that in Forces interview, I think, early 70s. His quotes were always the bravest, the most interesting quotes of anybody of the time. You know what I mean? Who would say that? He says, my buddy, he's on unemployment. He's just quit his job. He's out there in British Columbia having a good time. He said, there's obviously something new going on here where that can happen in society. And then he said, why do anything more than 6 months? He even said, what's the role of a wife? Why even have a wife? You didn't see many guys of his generation saying that kind of stuff. Well, you didn't see anybody saying it, right? So I admired his bluntness about the facts of what was happening that everybody was ignoring.
Right. But what was happening was that he was talking about this stuff, and at least until 1969 or so, people were lapping it up.
Yeah.
And sort of loving it. But they were comprehending it in Gutenbergian terms.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't getting anywhere.
Well, he had a backlash. He had a backlash to his image. And he saw that coming. And Morris McLuhan told me that in 71. McLuhan's brother said, we're not going out there and speaking for the next couple of years. We're laying low. We're going to retreat. We know that the people are starting to catch up to the devastation that the sort of made whatever positive visions they had from the 60s was canceled. Now it was what Lester Baines called the bland out. Everything was just the planet of the dead. And McLuhan and Morris said this to me. And what was interesting, Marshall didn't get back in the media till 74, and he was interviewed in Newsweek or someplace. And so he had a new program. He said, the problem with public transportation, bringing in system public transportation, it won't work. Americans go out to be alone. They go out there in their cars to think. They need cars. And that was pretty interesting. There he was pointing out that these dreams of having public transportation or any greeny dreams or ecological dreams of redesigned cities was not looking at the dynamics of what had already been established by the Western private identity up against this apocalypse, and their car was their new sacred bathtub, you know?
Correct. The car was what enabled you to go out to be alone.
Yeah. You could only do it in the car. So
yeah.
That dynamic, was not surmountable. So
no, and that's still going on. That's the motor of international affairs right now.
International what?
Affairs.
Yes. But what I admired about him, he was still doing his work, and he had a new pattern to explain or to x-ray the complexities that were going on that nobody was talking about. And he had a new bunch of things to say in the 70s.
I like you bringing in x-ray there. If we go back to the 1960s for a minute, if instead of the quadrivium plus satellite, cyborg, et cetera, if we put there the global theater plus satellite, cyborg,
yeah,
corporate media,
yeah,
then what we have is the global theater has become a fact, but it hasn't been understood, and we have to understand it through satellite, cyborg, myth, corporate media, in the same way that we had to understand the quadrivium through those other inventions, or the trivium through advertising and comics. So
right.
The movement is always, what do we have to probe in order to understand where we're at?
Right. And so do you see television was tactile. I understood that in the 50s and 60s. But then I realized, no, we're in massive interplaying environments. So I don't know if McLuhan ever said it, but I realized the interplay of the environments with massness and super angelic and autonomy was a kind of tactility, interpolation.
There it is. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I don't know if many people who saw the environment like that as tactility. They could see television as tactile eventually, but that was just one of many media. So I'm just making sure you understand, that's what I mean in that quote there, that there's a larger tactility going on, a macro tactility maybe you could say, and a global theater is a word for that. And even theater is too framed, it's too much of a visual word reference, the in framing, the proscenium arch, he called it. But were up against the satellite cyborg mixed corporate media. Now, the baby boomers didn't get that, but it was interesting. The punks in the late 70s, they started automatically treating themselves as cyborgs. You know what I mean? That that was a
sure.
given to them.
Well, same with the people doing graffiti.
Doing what?
Graffiti.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And, of course, it shocked people. And Norman Mailer is a radical. He comes out and he's all for graffiti. I remember him talking about it in the 70s. And he shocked his buddies because he didn't consider it an effacing. He thought it was an important art form, you know, on the subways of New York. And this we're trying to make it big, and it was big, but it's the end of the chemical body and probably the astral body too. And so you're going to get, with the digitization coming in, they start to make the TV body, which is the shrinking of the TV landscape and the shrinking of the satellite landscape, which creates a chip body. And those are amazing new devastations. But in the, I like Croker's phrase, we got surplus flesh. The chemical body wasn't even in the game anymore by the time of the 80s. And the Android meme replayed his art form through the chip body, retrieved certain ecstasies, millennial ecstasies for communication and hoiking up the individual or what people thought they were. You have that run for 20 years, and then that collapses into the ridiculous situation we're in now. So even the Android meme collapses and flips into the tech body. So that is my go ahead.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between the different bodies.
The relationship, did you say?
Yeah.
In other words,
is this a foundational plurality, or is there something even more foundational, something a little bit like tactility, that holds these things together even while defining them as separate?
Yeah, that's on my chart, the number 14 for the Croker quadrant. That's the meaning. One is the global membrane. Everybody's in the resonant node. All bodies are in the resonant node. But we spin off quadraphenically. That's the 4 of 14. It's not the 22 of the 60s, the analogical proportions of balance ratios that brings in the tetrad manager. You got the machine is running the show, and I call that the pentatic. That's the machinic tetrad manager. And that's the period of the Android meme. And the Android meme consists of the interplay more and more of the chemical body, astral body, TV body, and chip body, and the mystery body. I always included that there was things we didn't know, and who knows how they'll show up. I don't know if I thought of UFOs as that, but in retrospect, they are part of the mystery landscape. And it wasn't a mystery body yet. It was a mystery landscape. When ION came, ION articulated the mystery landscape, so then we could develop a mystery body, and take the mystery landscape as art form. So
you, at this point, you've gone beyond the stuff on page 80, I take it?
Yes.
You've gone beyond the 70s and up to the 90s.
2000s.
And now you're in the 2000s.
Yeah. Well, I tend to run the pattern, you know, and then go back and do it again.
That's all right.
Yeah.
I just want to know where we're at.
No. Now we're going back to page 80.
Okay.
It's important to understand how television, mixed corporate media, is a landscape in the 60s, or what you could call a medium. It's not an appendage on us. The super angel has not shrunk the landscape environments to organ size, barnacle size, which is what's going to happen to the television environment or the mixed corporate media hologram. And also what's going to happen to the computer world as it becomes a chip body. It's important to understand that these things were landscapes first, huge, Leviathan.
Do you mean by shrinking understanding?
No. Shrinking is the digitization, miniaturization, holopathic process. The hologram is made homeopathic and shrunk. So that by 2010, you have massive environments in your belt, and you don't even have to see them. You don't see. They're in your wrist. They're in the little cell phone. You got massive former huge landscapes are now shrunk. So,
right, but they, in order to be shrunk, in order to be on your wrist, they need to be understood in some sense. So on the one hand, people, based on what happened in the 60s and 70s, and 80s and 90s, they're now able to come up with new applications. But at the same time, they're coming up with new applications, throws light on what's going on at a deeper level. So you have two things going on at the same time. And they're both understandings, you could say. One is an understanding that will lead to application, and the other is an understanding deeper than that, or above that, which sees those things as explicable in new ways.
Yeah, and I mentioned this before, that's where the holopathic process is what Theo calls synesthetic and co-anesthetic. The co-anesthetic is putting you, whatever you are, I call it anthropomorphic physical, putting you more and more in the center of a media vortex that is tinier, getting more smaller than you. And so you're becoming bigger, but it's not your chemical body. It's becoming bigger, but you. What is that you? The core you, the thing that looks out, looks around, listens, and might imagine is human. What he called the citadel of consciousness, that is what's left. The raw citadel of consciousness, you know, by 2000 is in the middle of the vortex, the perfect storm, and juggling the five bodies. And the movement of being in the center is the co-anesthetic, and the mixture of the bodies, hallucinatory, synesthetic, absurdities of experience is the other dynamic. So there's those two dynamics that replace what he said in the 70s, increasing decentralization parallel with increasing centralization. So that leads to the Reagan era, 1984. But the bodies are a new situation. That was not anticipated by people. They thought they'd become a cyborg, a robot. They just thought about their chemical body being replaced. But you have now two extra bodies that you can't see. And you're not, most people aren't aware that you're made of these two bodies. They've been added to your astral and chemical. But you can look at any issue, social issue and problem, just take, you know, shooting in schools, you're dealing with four bodies there. And when you meet somebody, you're looking at somebody with four or five bodies, not one body. And they specialize in one or the other. They can be a TV couch potato, or they can be a hacker. Or they can be a fanatic fundamentalist in some form in the chemical body, though that overlaps into the astral body. And the chemical body is just overprotected and going through paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, and panic, and ecstasy. Mm-hmm. So, again, this is a quick capsule. I'm always using this same capsule. But I say that if you taught the five-body model in high school, it might help kids prepare for what they're going to be thrown out of once they're in schools. You know, once they're finished school, they're just thrown out there and disbanded. What is it? Abandoned, is what I'm trying to say.
So is there, what I don't get here, Bob, is I get everything that you're saying up to the point where you seem to be making an explanation. Whereas what I see happening in all this is ever increasing descent into the maelstrom And what we need is some sort of way to get out of the maelstrom, but we don't have it yet.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And McLuhan said to Richard Castellanos in January 67 in a New York Times interview, he was a young, literate, baby boomer critic, and he did some good interviews with McLuhan. And I noted McLuhan saying, people need concepts to get a grip on reality. Now, right. We know that he said, I don't deal in concepts, I deal in percepts. And so I thought it was comprehensive that he said, I'm writing books, and they're going to be perceived conceptually because books create the effect of the concept. So he says, I'm helping people get concepts. He still said, I'm apocalyptic, and we're in drastic times, but if you're going to be interviewed, you might want to look useful. So he said, I'm putting out concepts to help people get a grip on reality while they get ready to meet their maker, so to speak. That's how I'm offering the Tino chart and the bodies, as a conceptual thing, as an explanation for those that require an explanation. I don't think, McLuhan said, I don't explain, I explore, but he did explain as a subplot. He wrote books, so they create the effect of explanation. But it was not the whole matter. That's why, he was not categorizable, because he was doing so many different things going on in different
right.
media, and nobody else could do that. And his content was often the same content, which in the publishing industry, it turned against him because his books weren't innovative enough. He didn't make a totally different kind of book. It was just a replay of the same basic percepts and concepts targeting different parts of society. Cultures are business, redoing Mechanical Bride. Take Today for economists and politicians. Cliché Archetype for literary criticism. What else? Classroom for High School, City's Classroom. Through the Vanishing Point, Art History, Poetry History. War and Peace in the Global Village, a snazzy, flashy, avant-garde book like The Mediumist and Massage, right? So that appeals to the aesthetes in New York City. So he was communicating with the same ideas, but he managed to make the book and the design look different, and maybe because you didn't know everything that McLuhan was saying, you would read a counterblast, say, in 69, and there would be a bunch of ideas. Wow, look at that. I never heard of that before. And then years later, if you pursued it, you find an article that he wrote in the 50s, and what was in Counterblast 69, it was recycling something from 55, you know?
Yeah. So I would just add to that that I think what he was mostly doing in these later books was probing. He was indicating where in his mind lab, if he had more time to his life, these are things that he would explore. But since he could see the end of his life, he wasn't a well man at all after 1967 and
right.
arguably after 1960.
Yeah.
So when you think you have something important to throw out there, you can't worry about final form. You can't claim to have the final form. What you do is you say, look at this and take it further. And I think we're sort of there now. If you look back at, say, Take Today, it's incredible how much is in there
yeah.
that has never yet been understood. And this is 50 years later.
Yes. Yeah. It's like Phineas Wake. Phineas Wake was not comprehensible for obvious reasons. People don't recognize that you can read McLuhan. It's not a mishmash like Phineas Wake, but you don't take the time to read it, and you don't have the energy to read all of it. There's a lot in Take Today, so you don't even know what he's saying. So it's different from Phineas Wake, but it's the same hidden ground. Remember, he said in 1970 in a letter to Playboy, T.S. Eliot's auditory imagination is ordinary awareness today, but the sensibility that Phineas Wake is about is not in anybody's awareness yet. Okay, now it is. There's all kinds of Phineas Wake reading groups to take a mundane interpretation of that. But there's no awareness of what McLuhan's talking about. That has not entered into ordinary consciousness. Even though he's talked about a lot today, because it's the closest anybody can have for some reference point about what's going on or what they think is going on, but they don't know any of the stuff that he did and even proposed solutions to things.
Right. So we're the only McLuhan reading group going on.
Two people.
Yeah.
That's right. No, I'm proud to be a member of it. But the so now we go back again, cycle back, and I'll run through it again. This page 80. Pick up other aspects. I said, so far, McLuhan scholars have placed too much emphasis on the role of the trivium in the media poetics of McLuhan, and those scholars didn't get there till 2000. You know what I mean? They didn't even get to the trivium, start noticing it until the late 90s or the during the supposed McLuhan revival. The quadrivium is far more important as a creative ground for McLuhan's post-mechanical bright output. Nobody's demurred at that statement. Nobody's even noticed it. This article is posted on the McLuhan site, New Explorations. I've only had one review, a silly review from Michael Edmonds, who he just wanted to insult me.
I've put stuff up there, and I might as well have been farting in a windstorm. There's no reaction whatsoever, even though there's a challenge, a basic challenge, to what's going on at that website.
You have some articles on there?
Yeah, several.
I'm guilty of not going there and seeing what's going on.
All right, I'll send you links.
All right, that'd be good.
Why don't you look at my links, Bob?
Yes. Like, I looked at that Finn's Hotel the other day, but I didn't have time to read it. I'm too busy, sculpting the present.
Yeah.
I'm a satellite conductor. It's my term for real artists like McLuhan, modern artists, postmodern, paramodern. So let's look at what's next. The 1970s, the tetrad plus instant replay laser beam hologram. Now, that's pretty interesting. And the tetrad is a symbol for the word that makes the Marcus. The CIA, the intelligence agencies, controlling the news shows or what people are told to be concerned about. And it's not a simple George Orwell brainwashing. The agents, the intelligence agencies, know how to play it and are aware of the tetrad. They know that they'll flip into their opposite. They know things will be retrieved from what they attempt, and they know things will be obsolesced. Imagine making a movie about intelligence agencies. All you get is James Bond and the derivatives that came after him. What if he actually showed how a tetrad manager that understands McLuhan stuff, Kissinger understands it, and they actually trade this knowledge when they have their G7 meetings? Now, that would be interesting content for a movie, for a popular medium, or even a TV series. You see what I'm saying? That you can make a whole different kind of a presentation post the usual cliches of all those shows that do show intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm.
They're just riddled with cliches about reflecting the news.
Oh, they're useless.
But, yeah.
I think what you're saying is that the media are the new actors.
Yep.
And you have to understand the theater of those actors through instant replay, laser beam, hologram, et cetera.
Yes. And then you have the Hendiades of the Trivium via Aaron McLuhan. The ordering of the terms below are based on a chart of correspondences made by Eric. I found that when I did the archives. But these are conceptual issues, ancient issues. But it's all that Marshall added to his talks in the 70s. It was the five parts of rhetoric, the four levels of exegesis, a little bit on Hendiades. But then he was saying other things which were more of the present, like it's the planet of the dead, or we go outside to be alone, inside to be social. You know, the it's important what he added in the 70s, but it wasn't that much conceptually. But the way he acted in the 70s, he had to deal with, you know, the Vatican calling up and helping them with the terrorist problem, Aldo Moro and all that. You know, he was a public agent. He was a James Bond in terms of how media or newspapers and corporations saw him. He was still coming in and giving the big perspective on things.
But these little nuggets that you have in B,
yes,
are new things in the 70s, and they're very interesting, but they were embedded in a whole bunch of repetition.
Yep.
And one of the problems McLuhan had was he, as a man that wasn't well, he had to generate stuff, usually with the help of others, that would sort of come to be seen after he was no longer alive.
Yeah.
So to me, the big drama going on in your B is a very sick man attempting to go beyond where he had been before, namely the A things.
But, the what thing? What did you say? Namely?
In 1970s, you've got an A and you got a B.
Yeah, oh, the A thing. Yes, I see what you mean.
Yeah. So I'm saying B, to me, is his way of trying to go beyond A,
yeah,
but without having any real grasp on how to communicate this stuff, how to formulate it into something that people can look at after he's gone. It's a very difficult time for him.
Yeah, now tell me, you developed a, how did McLuhan fail to figure out the communication game for after he passed? What did, is there anything you would say he should have done? What did he attempt that didn't work?
The point of my blog is that McLuhan has to be understood digitally. So in McLuhan research, everything that constitutes that research is in print. Even at McLuhan websites, it's a print journal simply taken out of the print medium and put into the computer medium. But it's not a real digitality in the sense of what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
It's asleep. It's a way back in the 70s or the 60s or something like that. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to take McLuhan's stuff and bring out where he hints at things, number one. And number two, I'm trying to put his thought into the digital form where you can use the search function or the advanced search function to sort of take his stuff into the lab and probe it.
Yeah. All his books after Medium is a Massage, yes, were probes, but he, on the surface, pretended he was probing a particular area of society or a discipline. Do you agree with that? Like, take today, it's geared for politics and corporate managers.
Well, I would agree with that, except that what a corporation is, what a manager is, all of these things have imploded.
Yeah.
And that's the point of take today. So
yeah.
We can't say to people, okay, you know what a manager is, so just read take today and that'll explain to you more about being a manager. No, it explains to you how you have to go through the whole concept of management.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah, so he does through the vantage point, targeting the art world with the punchline, there ain't no art today.
Yeah, and the very title of Through vanishing point, expresses how you need to get at the meaning of words. Words do have meaning, but they don't have meaning on this side of the vanishing point.
Yeah.
They only have meaning on the other side of the vanishing point. Now, and that vanishing point is one way of talking about tactility or electricity.
Yes. So I have here B, Hendiades of the Quadrivium. What the heck did I mean? Hendiades of the Trivium, Hendiades of the Quadrivium.
Well, remember, you're talking about the tetrad here.
Yes, the tetrad and then A and B. So Hendiades is one by means of two. So the Trivium and the Quadrivium are the two aspects, but they implode, disappear, and you're left with the after image of the tetrad, which is the pentad. Do I have the pentad here further down? I don't do that, do I? I think I explain it later.
That could be. And that's, remember, I asked you what the relationship between the bodies is, and the pentad may be involved in that.
Yeah. If you move down a little bit, you see where I say the following pattern is a subplot for the quote above. McLuhan was forced to mime the new electric quadrivial. And then I have last word, cliche, art form, and archetype. That's interesting. That's quoting Howard Gossage in Hot and Cool. He writes an article, and he ends up by saying that media metamorphoses go through a new medium is the last word, then it becomes a cliche, then it becomes an art form, and then it becomes an archetype. And
right.
You know, that's laid out in 66, 67. But Marshall is working on cliche and archetype at the time with Wilford Watson, and he probably said a few words every now and then with Howard Gossage. So I thought it was a nice early pattern that everything was going to last word, cliche, art form, archetype. And I have here the trivial, rhetorical, dialectical, grammatical, rhetorical, the last word, immediately persuasive, action of the new effects. Dialectical is the cliche, action of resistance.
Where are you now?
I've just gone down a little bit from what we were looking at, below the Hendiades. Just go down half a page, 81.
So is this above or below the quotation from War and Peace?
War and Peace. What we were looking at, the 70s, the B part, it's just below that. Just slightly a couple of lines of data, and then you'll come to a Howard Gossage quote, and then the following pattern.
Yeah, I can see the following patterns, but I kind of lost where you were in that.
Yeah, you see it now.
Yeah.
So,
I was following you there before, but then you seemed to skip into something else. Maybe you didn't.
Well, yeah, last word, that's rhetorical. Cliché is dialectical. Art form is grammatical. And it's interesting, what I'm saying is the last word is the action of the new effects. Cliché is the action of resistance to the effects, action of the effects as metonymy, art form. And then the quadrivial is archetype, because basically you got nothing but archetypes happening in a quadrivial format.
Correct. And that the reason for that is that those words you have in quotation marks, the last word, cliché, the art form, those are always understood by anybody in a particular way.
Yeah.
And the particular way of understanding them is the archetype.
Yes. And you'll see I have action of the effects in cyclic simultaneity.
Right, exactly, Bob. You should have written simultaneity in big letters there.
Well, do you understand that it's like global village? Cyclic is not simultaneous.
No, it, sure it is. Sure it is.
Well, I think,
for example, think about any law in chemistry that you have oxygen and you put it together with iron and you heat it, then it becomes something else. Now, that becoming something else is not something that's only narrative. It's cyclic in the sense that it's always the case. So cyclic simultaneity is the understanding of science where we are now.
Right. So I was quoting McLuhan. He once, in the Cochos, he made a circle in his palm, and he said, the circle is visual space. So that sense of cyclic, and I was trying to have it, it's like a Hendiades, one by means of two. I wanted it to be paradoxical, like the phrase global village. You know, village is local, global is everywhere. So cyclic. So I'm interpreting using the word cyclic differently than you were citing.
But that points to archetypes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the action of the effects in cyclic simultaneity. Here's an interesting pattern. William Aaron Thompson talks about Freud discovers the instinctual unconscious, and then Jung discovers the cultural unconscious, the stories and poetry and mythic materials that are in most cultures. Then Thompson says you got Levi-Strauss picking up the action of myth in Aboriginal people. Then you have Foucault coming in with the industrial unconscious. You know, he talked about where schools came from, where hospitals came from, and prisons, you know, out of France.
Yeah.
So we'll call that the industrial unconscious. Then Thompson jumps to Gregory Bateson and talks about the environment, the pollution is the new unconscious. And what he misses is McLuhan's best definition of the unconscious is the archetypes of media. The technologies are the archetypes of the social unconscious. I think that's a revolutionary idea of looking at the unconscious, that your immediate environment is your unconscious. You know, you're not paying attention to it, all the parts of it, all the artifacts. So
if you really want to say the immediate environment, after all, immediate seems to mean not mediated.
Yeah, it's pretty unmediated now. You're plastered up against the insides of the robot.
Right. But that's like saying, here's something that we need to understand. It's not saying, here's my understanding. Right? Those are two very different things.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Here's what we need to understand. Not my understanding. It's what we need to understand. Yeah.
Right. And we'll understand it in the same way that when we really understand things, one of the first things we come to understand is that our understanding is limited. It's making, not matching.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of understanding media doesn't say, well, I know very well what media are, and I know the laws of media and all that sort of stuff. What he's saying is these are probes that we need to think through because we need to understand these things. Otherwise, we're just going to destroy ourselves.
Yeah. Do you find if you happen to take time to listen to commentary, panels, blogs, interviews, that it's irritating the language that people use, what they pretend is impressive, some guy, Jordan Peterson, comes on and throws out a few insights, everybody is bowled away by it. Do you find with your McLuhan knowledge that everything else is pretty weak?
Well, I'll put it this way. I don't do any of that.
Yeah, you know there's nothing there. You're not going to look.
Right. Right.
You might have looked 25 years ago and got to that point, well, no, this is a waste of time. So, just wanted to see if you're on the same page as me. And I'm not impressed with anybody that gets anywheres without any McLuhan knowledge. You know, this is the it's almost like the new Christianity. If you're a Christian and you want to know how to survive without just wearing your conscience on your sleeve, McLuhan gives you a new way to be, quote, a Christian.
Right. Yeah, and that's very important.
Oh, good. Glad you see that.
Oh, definitely. For example, sometimes I think of McLuhan as having a point of view through which to understand Julian Assange. And that is that if you look at the two sides, one side, the American prosecutor, is using words that have zero meaning. You know, human rights, and we're going to treat them gently, and all this sort of stuff. It literally has no meaning at all.
Right.
And then you have the other side where people are saying, this doesn't make sense. What the guy is saying contradicts reality. This is not a rational way of looking at Julian Assange. So then if we ask the latter people, if we say, well, what do you think of the cosmos when you say those things? Do you really think that there is ground for rationality, for making sense, for not contradicting yourself and all that? And 99.9999% of them would say no. They don't believe that there's any base. So McLuhan writes to Voegelin in 1953, and he says that if you want to understand what's going on in the world, you have to understand that everything is everything else. And what he means by that is that all of the supposed contests of point of view, all of the lawsuits, all of the difficulties understanding what armies are going to do, and all this sort of stuff, that none of these are actually different points of view. They're all the same point of view. And they are the same point of view because they're utterly unanchored. They're just, they amount, at the end of the day, they amount to nothing.
Yeah.
So for McLuhan, if the universe supports sense, in all senses of the word sense, if it supports rationality, if it supports social interest, then we have to draw the conclusions from that, that the 2,000 years of Christianity that was at the base of Western civilization wasn't talking about nothing, like all of these people think. It was talking about the foundation that is either there or not there. If you think it's not there, then go through the maelstrom that you're opening up for yourself. If you think it is there, then start going to church.
Yeah. Is Julian Assange back in North America? I didn't know that.
No, not yet. Not yet.
Oh, you're just anticipating.
I think they have different appeals that they can make.
Right, so you're just imagining what you're saying is what there is already being said by prosecutors.
Oh, yeah, they just finished a trial in which the British government agreed send Assange to the United States. So I believe that can still be appealed in various ways. But at this point in time, he's still in solitary confinement in a British jail.
And you quoted the prosecutor. Is that somebody in Washington?
No, it's an American prosecutor arguing to the British court.
Oh, okay. He's in Britain. All right.
Yeah.
So you're thinking about the Assange issue.
Well, lots of issues. I think that one of the most interesting things about McLuhan is that he insists that there are different levels to reality. And unless we can find a level of reality that does not fall through itself, then at the end of the day, we're going to destroy ourselves looking for some kind of false foundation.
Mm. You say reality must fall through itself.
No, I'm saying number one, if you want to find a foundation that holds, you have to go through the maelstrom. That's number one. Number two, all of these people that are holding our lives in their hands and the lives of all of the plants and animals, they rely on false foundations. And the only way for them to get out of it, therefore the only way to save ourselves, is for them to realize that they need to go through the maelstrom.
Yeah.
Or through the vanishing point.
Is there a third level?
No. No. There's many different levels. But at the end of the day, the level that holds is the religious level, which doesn't necessarily mean Catholicism, because the world has many different religions. But the one thing that most of the religions agree on is that there is a foundation to things that can be relied on.
Hmm. So it's always intriguing to hear you are telling us what we must do, and McLuhan failed to communicate. I think you have said you failed to come up with something yourself.
Sure. It's not the only way to see if communication about this stuff succeeds is to look at the world and say that there is a way for people to conceive of peace, P-E-A-C-E, and move towards it. And since we don't have that, and we're in very dire straits, and there's a need to try to find a way to communicate about that.
Right, and you're taking responsibility for that, personal responsibility for the situation.
Well, I'm trying to do it, but many, many people in the history of Western civilization, or for that matter, Eastern civilization, have tried to communicate these things, where we are now is the failure of that communication.
Yeah.
And if you take the Catholic Church isn't even able to communicate it to itself. Right?
That's right.
It's pathetic. It really is pathetic.
So, not much you can say word-wise about the situation. Other than you concentrate on explaining McLuhan. You think that's the only topic probably worth paying attention to.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think there's very, very great thinkers, Plato, Aristotle, Hegel, Heidegger. These are tremendous people. But I think that McLuhan may have a better chance of being communicable than they did. And so that's why I'm concentrating on him.
Why is that?
Why does he have a better chance?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he talks about stuff that people are familiar with.
Okay.
And so then what I do is I try to show that the things that we think we're familiar with, we aren't familiar with.
Yeah. Is what we're familiar with, is that what the phrase lingua franca refers to?
No, not really. That's a language that everybody understands, or that everybody might understand if they put their mind and effort into understanding it.
Yeah, you say we've got a double duty interrobang in relation to the lingua franca. The lingua franca is not what the issue is.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that, but I would say that in the physical sciences, for example, we have found a way of exploring things where people understand each other. That's the whole point of the scientific revolution. That maybe started with Galileo, or maybe started with Lavoisier, or wherever. But in the physical sciences, what is taught in schools is not different from what is going on in the world. And that's what McLuhan saw in the 1950s. He saw that he had an opening as an educational theorist to talk about why it is we don't have a schoolroom without walls. And sort of that's what he did for, let's say, 10 to 15 years.
Mm.
And he basically failed. He found out that people didn't understand what the hell he was talking about. And meanwhile, he was getting sicker and sicker. And so he had a bit of a problem on his hands.
So what do you say you're doing to remedy what he failed at?
Well, like I said earlier, there are very great ways to fail. And I wouldn't compare myself to people that failed greatly in the past. All I'm trying to do is raise issues that I believe lead in the direction of mutual understanding. And so I use McLuhan partly because he's a Canadian, a Western Canadian like myself, and partly in that he was raising issues that I think other people didn't do. But the issues that he raised oftentimes lead to Plato or Aristotle or Hegel or Heidegger, and then I talk about them in the book.
Right. Now, I claim to be offering solutions.
Uh-huh.
We are doing it. It's not surfacing immediately. Many things are, you know, cooking, and the troubles will continue, and then the world will beg for what we have. So I've got that unique vision of, I think I'm solving the issues for those that will survive what's happening now. What would you say, you know, you can be really honest, what would you say is erroneous about what I'm saying about myself? How am I failing? How am I not noticing I might be failing in what I...
Well, I mean, you have a way of presenting yourself as more than human, having impeccable insight, having trillions of dollars and all this sort of stuff. It's a way of...
And technologies and healthy remedies.
Yeah, yeah. So all of this is a way of saying these are reasons that you should be paying attention to me.
Yes.
But of course, it's not necessarily working. Right. The number of people that are paying attention to your claims, it's certainly much greater than the people that are paying attention to me. but I don't know that it's going to work in terms of, trying to, as Nietzsche said, trying to stop the wheel of history.
Yeah, we do have the elites listening to us. You don't know about that, but you can trust me. There's no point in me lying or making up shit. And I don't know how much that, I don't know how much the average citizen is going to be able to be cognizant of that. While it's unfolding, because they're being killed off rapidly. I don't know how many will be left here for when we do it. And the elites are a little more comfortable, and they've got their bunkers and safety. So they are definitely looking at us more and more, and that's pretty interesting and exciting. But we can't talk about it at this point. Apparently.
Well, there's also the problem that they have to understand you in a certain way.
Yeah.
But the problem is anybody who is listening to you and trying to understand you is trying to understand you through the perspective that is the problem. So how you get around that particular problem, I don't know.
In one-on-one engagements where I'm patient, and I'll take 3 days to to probe it with the person.
Then we completely disagree how many people there are in the world that know how to think. I don't believe that there are people out there that you've had special engagements with that now know how to think. I don't believe that at all.
Oh, okay. I get them to realize, yeah, I don't fully get Bob, but I think he's right. He's got the stuff. We're convincing more and more people of that. So less interference in when we make our moves. So I'm bringing this into the conversation. I think it's a completion of McLuhan. He failed, but I'm saying, no, we're not going to fail. And that's where my mediocology, my paramediocology got me to in this mm-hmm. situation. So that's what I'm thinking about. You know, that's what I'm aware of. I'm just telling you, I'm not hiding how I think about it. And I'm not mm-hmm. doing it to have a big ego or something. We have very practical things we do. I don't know if you know, I don't know if I told you this, the FDA called up Carolyn two Thursdays ago and said, you cannot communicate in public anymore. You cannot have a radio show. You cannot have any testimonials of what your products do for people. We are saying you have to be an un-person. Now, we're not going to stop your company. People can still buy your products, but you can't say anything about them. That's, and I tell people this, they're shocked. That's most people say, well, you can't stop someone's radio program because they kind of believe, you know, freedom of speech and you can have a show. You got to be careful about what you say. But
I'm familiar with those sorts of claims by the FDA. The FDA basically says, if you want to make certain claims, then you need to make studies.
Yeah.
And we have to see that those studies are unbiased and that they result in the confirmation of your claims. Now, somebody like yourself and your wife, you may not want to spend the millions or hundreds of millions of dollars that are required to do such studies. And if you're not, then they're restricted from making claims. It's just that simple.
Right, and Carolyn doesn't make claims. Years ago, she kind of made claims, and they told her to stop that, and she stopped it. So she's been doing 3 or 4 years of no claims. She just tells people they have a problem. She says, well, this is what I would do. Not saying it applies to you, but this is what I would do. And then they would do what she would do, and they'd get better. But no, she hasn't. They shut her down, even though she's followed all their constrictions mm-hmm. and rules.
But that's because, bureaucrats are free to interpret things as they will.
Yep.
And by and large, they claim a kind of infallibility.
Yeah.
Like the Pope, right?
Yeah.
And on the other side, aside from the bureaucrats wanting to defend their privilege, on the other side, there are the companies that are in the same market as you guys. Now, you may say, oh, that's not the same market at all. We're different. But that's not for you to say. The people that think you're in the same market, they then go to the FDA and they complain, and then the FDA responds to their complaints by saying something like they did a couple Thursdays ago.
Yeah.
So then the result of all of that is that you can go to court. You can say that this is illegal, wrong, or something like that. But again, that takes a huge amount of money and time and energy.
Right. So here's the other aspect. You talk about these bureaucrats living in their own world. Carolyn can advertise, can't make claims, but testimonials of people who buy her products can happen on Amazon. Amazon is too big for the FDA to go after. So the FDA can't go to the big places like that, but they can operate in the little world of medicine and Health, whatever it is they do, Food and Drug Administration, and they can target people like Carolyn in their little world, and there's so many other environments and worlds going on that nobody would notice. So, yes, right. The FDA bureaucrat can do tiny targeting.
Yeah, but they can also do mega targeting, Bob. That's just if the Washington bureaucrats start getting on Amazon's case, which they don't have to do through lawsuits. They can just write a letter and say, you know, this doesn't seem to be something you should be doing for your own good. Amazon, you know, they don't care about you guys selling your products or anything. They care about their relationship with the government as one of their highest priorities. So they can easily stop you there if they want.
Who, the FDA?
Yeah. All they need to do is write a letter to Amazon or maybe other pharmaceutical companies.
The strange thing is they don't.
What's that?
The strange thing is they don't. They don't.
What I'm saying is not yet, maybe.
Okay, but no, they for years the Carol's noticed this, that, you know, companies can get away.
Okay, good. That's the only way to get ahead in this life is if you're going to do something that's new and unusual, it cannot fit into the old categories.
Yeah.
So
that's definitely good. What we've been doing.
It takes balls to, you know, deal with new stuff.
Yeah. Now, just for those who are listening and might be concerned, they know about Carolyn. And Carolyn's very delighted this has happened. She doesn't have to waste time talking to people. Her archives, which are hard to get to now, but, you know, there's a whole 10 years or more of information available for people, easily defined on all the different topics. But she is going into the lab and to make stuff, new stuff, which we have arrived at. So she's very happy in her own situation to have the time to do what we have to do now. While we wait out this period that people say, you know, it might get better later, but it's going to get worse first. That's the common meme now. Have you heard that?
No. Well, I mean, obviously I've heard it said about many, many things in life, but I've never heard it said about your situation.
No, not about us. I'm talking about the tribulations the world is in now. And a lot of people say, well, I have hope that humanity's going to turn around and do this and that, but it's going to get worse first.
Mm-hmm.
They agree on that. It's going to get worse. So the people want it to get worse almost. So while we're in this worst period.
Well, they're protecting their prediction.
Right. And
right? If the prediction doesn't seem to be working out, then you say, well, but I predicted that it would get worse first.
Yeah. My prediction would get worse. My prediction would be so erroneous. It would look bad. So in this period of, you know, colossal confusion and ignorance, it's a good time for Carolyn to retreat and do what she has to do anyways, just she has more time now. So that's the good news. Just want to tell you that this is good news, what's happened for us.
Okay. Do you have some kind of lab out there in Maui?
No, she just does it in the kitchen.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, she has, you know, an interesting way, you know, a few utensils, but no glorious lab. I mean, she works with natural things, but she makes quite powerful stuff, you know, based on secret processes.
Mm-hmm.
She ain't telling people how she does it. So I think about what McLuhan did, and I think about what you say about his failure. It's interesting. Did he take on a bigger issue than anybody else? So a more glorious failure? Or you like to say, and I remember, that everybody failed so far.
Right.
Of the greats.
Right. So, I mean, we wouldn't be in the cul-de-sac threatening to blow ourselves up if there were some recognized successful communication of our common humanity. There isn't. And it's a very, very dangerous situation.
Well, we've been talking for 44 weeks about how dangerous it is. How long does the danger be held off? Now, you don't know, but do you think that we get another couple of weeks?
Well, who knows what's going to happen with Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
But the key thing is that, for McLuhan at least, it's very important to realize that we have a tactile relationship with the past, including the pre-Christian past.
Yeah.
And in that vast period of time since history began, let's say that was 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, there have been disaster after disaster. So anybody that thinks that the foundation of things in some kind of religion is a guarantee against disaster is nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just that we have to learn how to listen to that history in the same way that we need to listen to the sorts of things you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, for example, you're talking about five parts of rhetoric. You're talking about the four Aristotelian causes, the levels of exegesis, etc. And then earlier than that, you're talking about listening to what's going on with advertising, comics, telephone, motor car, movie, radio, television, etc., etc. So the key to all of this stuff is to realize that we have an existing relationship to this stuff that includes the possibility of understanding them. And not understanding in some sort of that's the final moment of history, but understanding them the same way the physical sciences do, where people do research and are continually overturning what yesterday was thought to be true, but the science itself is not thought to be useless or inapplicable.
Say that last bit again about what's inapplicable. Just your last sentence or two.
I said that just because science does not come to absolute final answers about anything doesn't mean that it's not applicable.
Yeah.
Science is very applicable. Everything around us is the result of science. So what we want is a similar sort of lab work, I'm now calling it, on human experience that results in the classroom without walls.
Right. Now, we're coming to the end, so I wanted to say something.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go back up here. And I say, the issue is not, this is on bottom of 79. Yeah, bottom of 79. The issue is not orality and its spin-offs. It's tactility squared, which has flummoxed all cultures and has them scrambling for new or old identities. The millennials can be understood under this carapace. Then I say, McLuhan, in Understanding Media, talks about how the desire for more money is a tactile expression. The excessive desire to make money by any means necessary in all of our Gutenbergian and Marconian institutions since the 70s period of stagflation is a little noted example of the Baroque spiral of tactility squared. Emphasizing shareholder values to the exclusion of hardware development is not an extension of visual space, but the endless, involving process of expanding, exploring the resonant integral, popularly known as Wall Street. Then I say, the tactility of television then became the global hologram of mixed corporate media environments, which were interplaying like tactility. Then the Android meme imploded it all, shrunk it, and permitted tactility cubed, went to a third level. So far, McLuhan scholars have placed too much emphasis on the role of the trivium in the media poetics of McLuhan. The quadrivium is far more important as the creative ground for McLuhan's post-mechanical bright output. Now, we discussed most of this, and I'm restating it, and to me, it's the last thing to write. You're writing, doing McLuhan. I think McLuhan is the last thing to talk about in terms of reading a monologue or reading something in one language. Parallel to that is Finnegan's Wake. So I intend, when I make these statements or this layout, I tend it to be, I'm hoping it for it to be the last word, and then one studies from it. You jump off with the advice that the article gives you, the book gives you, key points that have to be gotten. Maybe you have to go and look up the sources I present for people to find out what I'm talking about. But the I don't see anything worth reading because the activity of reading is obsolete, and you're processing what's in the news. We're all processing what they say is the news, and I say that's the tech body, which we're moving towards explaining closer each week. We actually have moved into the silent sea that McLuhan liked to talk about.
Uh-huh. Is that the tech body, is that something that that is happening to us? Is it something that anybody understands? Is it simply a kind of maelstrom into which we're hopelessly entangled? What is it?
It's all those, but it is something we can understand. But the unique thing that I offer is I actually can talk to it. And we went over the interview with it. That's pretty uh-huh. incredible. Most people say, you know, AI is coming down to get us. Watch out for AI. But they don't know where AI is, and they can't talk to it.
Right.
I'm saying the tech body. Say this.
That's one of the main things that we're exploring in your book here,
yes,
is that you have a way of thinking that's far different from my way of thinking. But it's a very interesting approach to McLuhan, and perhaps it's a very interesting approach to things that are much bigger than McLuhan.
Yes.
In the world today. And that way of thinking is basically a way of talking to these issues in dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's a peculiar thing that I'm trying to understand more about as we proceed.
Yeah, no, that's what I do. And so the final thing was, I was saying that I can actually draw up, quote, the enemy, or what's presenting itself as our enemy right now, and talk to it and present dialogues with it. That's pretty incredible. If you believe it, then I'm talking to something that is beyond all the science fiction scenarios. I mean, they got the new Matrix movie out, and his last Matrix, if you remember, if you watched it, the third movie, he ends up talking to something like a tech body or a god or something. And then there's consequences, and then the movie has a nice ending. But the I predicted how the Matrix would have to go, so I haven't made any predictions about the new thing. I don't even know if I'll go see it, but I'll see it someday. I'll be very curious to see if it follows along with what I've done since the last one, which was about 2003, you know, 15 years, 20 years ago. No, 18 years ago. I'm just reminding you of the uniqueness of the tech body part that I'm trying to illustrate, that we can actually talk to it. There's, you know, nobody else can lay out a science fiction scenario and then claim that they can talk to it. This is very original to do this.
Right.
And to pull it off.
I think that's true. I would understand it a little bit different. I would say that what technology has been up to since, let's say, the time of television in the late 1920s, it's been figuring out how to externalize
the inner trip.
Pardon me?
The inner trip. How to externalize the inner trip?
Yeah, but the thing about television that McLuhan really liked is it's synesthetics. It brings together the senses that we know how to externalize.
Yeah.
So part of the externalization of the senses is the externalization of the language function. And the externalization of the language function kind of underlies all of the things that have been possible through electricity and through the digital.
Yeah.
So the language function, in turn, is a kind of way of thinking, a way of processing stuff, and it should be talkable to if it really is an externalization of language, of the synthesis of the various senses, then talking to it would seem to be the way to understand it. And that's what I think you're doing.
Yeah, and remember, McLuhan said that in Hot and Cool, in Stern's book. He said, I'm going back and giving it the old what for. I'm kicking back. I'm talking back.
Yeah,
that's what he said you had to do. You had to talk back to the environment. Okay, well, that's a good point to end. See where it goes next time.
Okay. We should. I'll send you a note saying that we're at the top of page 81 or something.
Right. All right. I appreciate that. Okay.
Yeah.
Have a holiday if you're going to have one. Have a good holiday.
You too, Bob.
And we'll talk in 2 weeks.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Cameron.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.